proclaiming the gospel to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Shalom and welcome to the Everlasting Nation Broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. I'm your host, Aaron Broughton, and I want to thank you for joining us today. Over the next programs, I would like to discuss with you a very important subject that I believe is central to the eternal plan of God. We will look at the fact that Jerusalem and Israel are indeed inseparable. On our last program, we discussed that Jerusalem and Israel are inseparable because of historical right. Jewish people have been in the land of Israel ever since Moses and Joshua when they brought the children of Israel into the Promised Land. Even though the Jews have faced exile and persecution over the centuries by the Assyrians, Babylonians, the Romans, as well as others, the Jews have always had a remnant in the land. Over 3,000 years ago, King David conquered Jebus and established Jerusalem as the political capital of his kingdom. God has Jerusalem close to his heart. This is reflected in his relationship throughout the ages, especially with people like Abraham. Consider God's covenant with Abraham in Genesis 15. This is the covenant with Abraham and his descendants regarding the promise of the land. God literally put the burden of proof upon himself in this covenant, and he will not break his promise as mentioned in Romans chapter 11 and verse 29. We see from this that the most important historical tie to the Jewish people, to Israel and Jerusalem, is the fact that God promised and gave this land to Abraham. We will now look at that Israel and Jerusalem are inseparable because of spiritual right. Even as David established Jerusalem as Israel's national capital, his son Solomon built the temple and made Jerusalem Israel's spiritual capital. Jerusalem, or Salem, is the city of Melchizedek, the king of Salem, the same city where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob worshipped. Even before Moses led the children of Israel into the land of Canaan, God promised Israel a place of worship according to Deuteronomy chapter 12. When David brought the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, it solidified the fact that Jerusalem would be the center of worship for Israel and ultimately the whole world. After Solomon completed the temple, God himself said, "For now I have chosen and sanctified this house, that my name may be there forever." That's 2 Chronicles chapter 7. The temple became the focal point of Jerusalem through the years of Israel's history and remained special to the heart of the Jewish people in spite of its destruction and absence. It is important to note that the Western Wall is not the holiest site in Judaism, but the Temple Mount is. The Jewish people have centered their attention on Jerusalem as they travel three times a year during the special feasts of Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles according to Leviticus chapter 23. It was from Jerusalem that Israel was to be the light and salvation to the Gentiles to bring them out of darkness, according to Isaiah 49. This was fulfilled as Jesus the Messiah, the light of the world, sent forth his gospel beginning in Jerusalem, according to Acts 1:8. Even though Israel, as a nation, is spiritually blinded to the gospel, their spiritual ties to Jerusalem are undeniable. At the end of every Passover Seder, the Jewish people say collectively, "Next year in Jerusalem." The religious Jewish people pray daily for Jerusalem and even face in the direction of Jerusalem itself. Israel's national anthem, Hatikvah, tells of the hope of the Jewish spirit to be free in the land of Zion and Jerusalem. The first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, said, "We regard it as our duty to declare that Jewish Jerusalem is an organic and inseparable part of the state of Israel, as it is an inseparable part of the history of Israel and the faith of Israel." As the controversy rages about Israel's right to exist, God will protect his people and his land and his city. There cannot be one without the other. Truly, in the heart of the Jewish people, Jerusalem and Israel are inseparable. Now, with this in mind, let's now go to our teacher and Jewish believer, Brother Mark Oshman, with our Bible study for today.
Thank you for listening to our program. In the past several sessions, we have looked at 10 principles for conquering stubborn habits. The fourth principle sets forth this supposition: we cannot fight a fleshly appetite by indulging in it. At first glance, such an admonition seems obvious. After all, a fireman does not quench a fire by throwing additional fuel on it. However, Some people still try to combat fleshly desires by yielding to them. Giving in to inordinate desires cost the Israelites in the wilderness. It cost them dearly, as recorded in the 11th chapter of the book of Numbers. The Jewish nation murmured against God because they missed the food of Egypt. They hated the manna that God gave them from heaven. They longed for meat to eat. God responded by bringing a covey of quail from the sea and sending those birds into the Israelite camp. It took the Israelites a day and a night to gather the quarry. However, their desire, though satisfied, had negative consequences for them. Here's how the author of the book of Numbers put it, quote, "While the flesh was yet between their teeth, ere it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord smote the people with a very great plague." Unquote. Furthermore, as the author of Psalm 106 put it, quote, "He gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul." Unquote. The author of Ecclesiastes also placed a lot of emphasis in order to satisfy his desires. Since he lived as the king over Israel and Jerusalem, nobody had the power to thwart his will. Moreover, he had every opportunity to be able to satisfy his whims. The author of Ecclesiastes sought to acquire wisdom. Such an endeavor would serve to bolster his intellectual prowess. In the first chapter of that book, though, he described his efforts to do so as, quote, "a sore travail," unquote. Had he asked God for wisdom, God would have granted it to him, according to the first chapter of James' epistle. Instead, the author of Ecclesiastes and his efforts to gain wisdom only brought him grief and sorrow. The author then gave himself over to experiencing pleasure. He tried to find contentment in humor, an effort that also proved unrewarding. In the 7th chapter of Ecclesiastes, the author compared the laughter of fools to the sound of thorns crackling under a pot. The author of Ecclesiastes undertook activities designed to give meaning to his life. He supervised the construction of houses. He had others cultivate for him vineyards, gardens, and orchards. He had pools of water built to irrigate the trees he had planted. However, none of these things gave him contentment. Another way in which the writer of Ecclesiastes sought to find meaning in life involved the pursuit of riches. He added numbers of servants to his household. He acquired livestock, as well as getting silver and gold. He hired singers and purchased musical instruments for musicians. As he put it, though, quote, "Whatsoever mine heart desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy," unquote. How effective did this strategy prove? According to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, it didn't prove effective at all. The author concluded that, quote, "I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun," unquote. In other words, he thought that all of his efforts only resulted in emptiness and vexation of spirit. Indulging in his desires brought the author of Ecclesiastes no sense of fulfillment. Instead, as he wrote, quote, "I hate life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit," unquote. Living for pleasure has adverse consequences. In Proverbs 21, Solomon wrote that, quote, "He that loveth pleasure shall be a poor man. He that loveth wine and oil shall not be rich." Furthermore, engaging in self-indulgence will drive a person away from God. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, Paul warned that during the last days, men would become lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. In and of themselves, human desires are normal, yet people still need to control them. If a reverse situation exists, where unbridled appetites take control of a person's life, such an individual will have no higher yearning than to satisfy the cravings of his flesh. In the 16th chapter of Romans, Paul described such individuals when he wrote about those who served their own belly. How can someone avoid winding up in such a condition? he or she needs to exercise self-restraint. Peter exhorted his own readers to do this in the second chapter of his first epistle. Quote, I beseech you, as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. Unquote. If a Christian expected to triumph in the spiritual arena, he needed to exercise temperance. In the ninth chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul addressed the subject by employing the analogy of an athlete training for competition. Quote, Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. Unquote. Paul applied that metaphor to his own efforts in maintaining his own spiritual discipline. Quote, I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body, and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. Unquote. Paul realized that indulging in his fleshly appetites would thwart his intention to live for Jesus Christ. By practicing temperance, he maintained his fitness to serve as a vessel for his master's use. The apostle must have realized that he could never carry out that determination in his own strength. His statements in Romans chapter 7 indicated that when it came to obeying God, he lacked the will to carry out any course of action upon which he had resolved. Nonetheless, Paul understood that as a Christian, he needed to reckon himself as dead in connection with living in order to indulge his own appetites. In the third chapter of Colossians, Paul instructed his audience to place their affections upon things in heaven and not upon earthly matters. He reminded them that they had died, spiritually speaking, and that their lives as Christians lay hid in Jesus Christ. Therefore he commanded them, quote, Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, unquote. While the term mortify derived from a Greek verb that meant to put to death, Paul utilized it in the book of Colossians in the sense of depriving something of its power by destroying its strength. Believers needed to regard their sinful desires as ineffectual insofar as it would motivate them to do sin. Paul further expounded upon this subject in the sixth chapter of Romans. He asked his readers, quote, How shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? Unquote. Paul provided the explanation for that question. Quote, Our old man is crucified with him, that the body of sin might be destroyed, that henceforth we should not serve sin. Unquote. When individuals became Christians, they died in Jesus Christ. Therefore, fleshly appetites no longer had the power to compel them to transgress against God. The apostle then admonished the Roman congregation, quote, Let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body, that ye should obey in the lust thereof. Neither yield ye your members as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin, but yield yourselves unto God as those that are alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness unto God. Unquote. Just as fleshly desires cannot influence somebody who has died physically, they should likewise have no power over those who have died in the spiritual sense of that term. Indulging in fleshly appetites will only increase a believer's willingness to submit to those cravings. Christians need to recognize that they do have fleshly desires, but they also need to determine such influences will exercise no power over their behavior. They need to reckon, in other words, that they have died unto sin, but that they live unto God. Thank you for listening to this radio broadcast. We invite you to return for future programs relating to principles involved in overcoming stubborn habits.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee 37343, or call us at 423-876-8150, or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.